Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
The topic of death has gotten so political lately. Now, Senator John McCain is apparently making his funeral arrangements and putting together his guest list. He doesn't know how long he's going to be living. He says that Mike Pence could come to his funeral, but Donald Trump, he's not invited, okay? And to me, it sounds like you're planning a five-year-old's birthday party and you're saying who's invited and who's not invited. But I think Donald Trump should go. I really think he should go to the funeral, and I really think he should be wearing a red dress. Who would you invite to your funeral? I don't know who I would invite to my funeral. I don't want to think about that. I don't know if I'd want to have a funeral. I think I just want to be spread over the ocean or something and eaten by some lobster so then someone else could eat me at a very expensive restaurant with lots of butter. I don't know. But anyway, cremation. Yeah, that's an interesting topic. I have a neighbor who lives across from me in Palm Springs, and she's a very nice woman and stuff. And my father just hated speaking to this woman. He hated hanging out with her. I mean, my mom loves hanging out with her and going to the casinos and playing those penny slots and just talking until the wee hours of the night. And my mother really loves this woman, but my father really hates her. And one day I asked him, I'm like, hey, so why do you hate the neighbor lady so much? You know, what's your deal? And he's like, do you know why I hate her? And I'm like, no, it's why I'm asking you. And he's like, I hate her because she's always talking about death. And it's true. She always did talk about death because she worked in the death industry. At the time, before she was retired, she worked for Forest Lawn and she was a cremation specialist. Like, she was the consultant or the counselor. So whenever you died and you needed to be cremated, she was the lady who took care of that. And she always had stories to tell about the people that would come in. And so that's why she was always talking about death. And that's why my father didn't like talking to her, because he hates to talk about death. And today we're continuing on our podcast about death, and we're going to go a little bit more in depth with our storyteller, comedian Lisa Medway. She's going to finish up her stories about her mother and the whole hospice process. And we have our nurse specialist, or our nurse expert, Michelle Lasota, also known as the nurse with the purple hair. And we're going to be talking about what roles opiates play and the importance of legacy stories, death doulas, death decluttering and cleaning. So just come on, listen in, and here we go.
I want to ask you, because I think this is so important. My sister and I had a lot of friction and conflict because for somebody who took as many drugs as she did in the 70s, she suddenly became really anti-medication. And the few times that my mother was administered a combo of morphine and Ativan, my sister was horrified. She wasn't even in the city or the state, and she would just have a spaz. And she was so uneducated, and she just heard those words. She heard they were going to be given to her mother that she had her.
Yeah. I think this is a really good point that you're bringing up, Lisa, because right now with all the opioid addiction as well, it's right. Huge controversy. I was reading several articles this morning about this. Can you go ahead and speak a little bit more on this, Michelle? Then we'll go back to your movie.
My point is.
Yeah, your point.
Shirley MacLaine, Lisa. In terms of endearment, I'm rewriting it. Give my mother the damn drugs. It's like my mother at 96 is not going to become an
addict, exactly.
When she has one dose of low-dose morphine and Ativan, which for an old person is the proper protocol So people are so ignorant. And so Michelle, as the expert, maybe you can add your expertise to my commentarianism on that. Because I was pro drugs. My sister was like suddenly, you know, Miss Holistic Christian Scientist. And we had a battle about that.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I think there's tremendous controversy right now about the opioid epidemic, and you know, it's real. And I think that it's so unfortunate when someone is really, you know, suffering through an extended journey and disease process. And so here's something to remember. You know, medicine has to change along the way of any journey because your body's changing. And there are just different checkpoints where whatever disease you're fighting just gets smarter than the medicine. It's that simple. And, you know, you have to change it to manage those symptoms of whatever's happening to keep someone comfortable.
That is a genius comment, by the way.
I'm sorry?
That was a genius comment, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Are
getting smarter than the medicine.
And I think dying is very painful. Like, your body is shutting down.
Right.
Go ahead, Michelle.
You're exactly right. I think regardless of whatever disease, and, you know, I think people also assume that hospice has to be, you have to have a cancer diagnosis in order to be on hospice. And that's not true either. You know, any illness, there's end stage cardiac disease, there's kidney disease, there's liver disease, there's all of these things, that lung disease, you know, they all manifest symptoms and they all follow the same pathway. And regardless of what you're fighting, when you're dying, at some point, everyone's body goes into multi-system organ failure. Mm-hmm. Everything shuts down. It just shuts down differently based on what's happening in your body. And, you know, those medicines are there to treat the discomfort and not, you know, it's not to make someone, you know, snowed. That terminology makes me crazy. Or just, you know, they come and they knock her out. And so here's something to think about. Even if you have a headache, when you're in pain and you don't have access to just aspirin to get rid of that headache, and you're dealing with that headache all day, when you get home and you finally can get that aspirin, you are exhausted. You're overexhausted because you've been tolerating that discomfort for so long that you need extra time to recoup, allow the medicine to work, allow your body to catch back up. It's really that simple in those big illnesses too. So the longer that you push through symptoms, whatever they are, whether it's difficulty breathing, whether it's physical pain, whether it's anxiety, the longer you are tolerating that before you get something to treat it, you're utilizing energy that you could be using to do, you know, many different things that would better affect your quality of life than to just, you know, exhaust yourself from untreated symptoms. And so, you know, I understand it really makes me sadden that our older generation, you know, they're seeing on TV all these, you know, concerns about addiction and they're terrified, but they're taking this medication for all of the right reasons. And that is the biggest difference.
I think that's a great point that you're bringing up. Excellent.
It's so important. It's
huge
because I'm disabled. I know pain and I have spine disease and a couple of other things. And I hope I don't sound like I am impaired in this podcast, but I take medication. I am not an addict, but I suffer from chronic pain. It's exhausting. Chronic pain is so fatigue making. And I would see my mother laboring to breathe with COPD and with emphysema and as her skin was breaking down, and that was just what was visible happening to her inside. So it's very difficult for long distance relatives to realize what is occurring in a person who is suffering with what the labor-intensive activity of losing your life over a long period of time.
I also want to say to you too, just getting back to the, you know, using the medication to treat whatever the symptom is, it is much easier to stay ahead of a symptom once you get ahead of it than it is to catch up. And so I think a lot of times, you know, when symptoms are untreated or this is a new introduction of a different goal of care, you know, there's an explanation, there's an education process to understanding that our goal is to get ahead of those symptoms and stay ahead of those symptoms, right. You know, and, you know, what's the end result? You have more, you have a better quality of time, a better utilization of your energy to really focus in on what it is that you want to do with the time that you have left and how you wish to spend it, regardless of what you do with it. But it's so disheartening to see people suffer.
Yeah. I think that's one of the worst things when someone is dying is the suffering. And isn't that what really hospice is all about, is to make someone comfortable during the end of life process and stuff.
Of course.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Finish your point. Yeah.
The goal with the film, you know, the goal in making that film, I mean, one, it was just a labor of love for both of us. And if I wanted anybody to take away anything from it, it was three things. I wanted to encourage people to just ask more questions. You know, don't wait for your physician to ask you or vice versa, or for your patient to bring it to you. I think everybody should be, you know, I just want to encourage you to ask more questions. And I want people to feel inspired to be brave enough to have conversations that matter. You know, think about that. How many conversations do we have day to day? You know, but I want people to have conversations that matter. And that takes being brave to broach subjects or topics or stories or things that are uncomfortable. And ultimately, I want everyone to feel empowered to make informed decisions. You know, I think that we assume that when we're facing, you know, things, especially in the medical community, we as lay people assume that all of our options are being laid out on the table. And I think that, you know, it's a 50-50 marriage there. You know, I think that the medical community has a half responsibility to bring you all the knowledge that they can, but not every clinician can know everything. We don't. It's just not going to happen. And because we're all human. And I think as a layperson, it's also our responsibility, you know, to bring some things to the table. And I find that a lot of times, because this particular subject is avoided, that people find themselves in moments of crises, and they're given, you know, they're oversaturated with information. And there's, you know, depending on what your family dynamic is, there's so much going on. And when you're given two very difficult options to choose on what to do to treat your loved one, you really struggle to make the best decision with the options that you were given. But how would you feel if you found out after the fact that there was a third option that was never put on the table but absolutely existed?
Right.
I think that's a great point. What I want to go into, Michelle, is a little bit deeper into your film. What I liked is when you talked about your one patient, Frank, I believe, right? He was the ballerina. Kind of tell a little bit of his story. I think his story is very fascinating because he kind of was reclusive, and you went to go and you were doing home visits with him initially.
Yeah. So Frank, I love Frank.
And it's such a great story. I love that part of the movie is my favorite.
I consider Frank to be like my foundation in hospice. So I had gotten sent to see Frank because he was a patient who newly came onto hospice, and he wasn't answering the phone. And they said, you know, can you just stop by and make sure, you know, we want to make sure he wasn't, you know, lying on the floor or hurt or something and couldn't call for help. So I tried to get in touch with him all day long. He didn't answer. And then I finally decided to go to his house. This was my first visit. And in short, he ended up answering the door after quite a bit of time. And he was pissed. He was pissed that I disturbed him, that I didn't call ahead. You know, who was I to just show up? And I explained that I had tried, you know, I tried and I just wanted to make sure he was okay. And I was happy to come back if this didn't work out. And so he shut the door, and I got halfway to my car, and he opened the door and he called me down the street, and he called me back, and he said, I changed my mind. I figured since you've disturbed me, you might as well come in. And so I fell in love with Frank that day, I think, because we had such a sarcastic banter back and forth with one another. And at the end, when I was leaving, he said to me, you know, you're like the scrappy little pup. Nobody wants you, yet you just won't go away. And I learned, you know, through my time with Frank that, you know, he was recluse because he was homosexual, and his family, he had members of his family that were not receptive to that. He had struggled with his dad, and he had some, you know, disconnect. And so he sort of stayed tucked away, and he didn't let people in very easily. And over time, you know, the utilization of hospice, Frank opened himself up to allowing the different members of the team to come in and really made a difference in his life. He really connected with a lot of our volunteers. And his story is so special because there are different levels of hospice care. And so Frank was on and off service for a total of 6 years. And wow. He would be on service. He had a disease process that sort of plateaued. And then he decided he wanted to seek, you know, curative treatments again. And people don't know that you can, you know, hospice isn't set in stone. You can revoke that service to change your course of treatment and your goals of care at any time. So Frank had come off service, sought treatment, relapsed, would come back on. You know, he was receiving home hospice, which is considered routine level of care. So routine level of care is wherever home is, whether it's in a facility or at your house. And that means that your disease process, all of you meet the eligibility criteria for hospice, but your symptoms are managed in a way that everything's sort of under control. You know, the nurses are coming in similar to what you had, and they're checking things and they're adjusting things along the way. And then Frank utilized respite care because he lived alone. So there came times where his disease process prohibited him from doing that safely. And we removed him from his home to give, you know, to get the caregiver situation reorganized and put him in a facility, which is a very short term, 5 to 7 days. And then there were times that Frank needed inpatient care, which I describe as if there was an ICU level of hospice, that's what general inpatient level of care is. And so he would be put into a hospice inpatient unit where it was all hospice, you know, a whole hospice team, hospice medical directors, managing those symptoms with the goal of returning back home or passing there if, in fact, his disease process continued and that's where, you know, his trajectory put him. And so he was a beautiful usage of that entire benefit. And I say benefit because hospice is a benefit. You know, it's something that you're paying into your whole life, you know, and so it's really... It's also disheartening to know that people don't get to utilize that benefit that they absolutely have earned and deserve. So,
yeah, I think it was a great story. And you got very close to him because he was a ballet dancer. So he showed you all his pictures. He had gone to the White House, right? So he was a very special individual. And I think it was so great. What really touched me was he was really able to share those high moments of his life that his family may have not have accepted, but his nurses had accepted, especially you, and stuff, right to the end of his death, where his last wish was ice cream, right?
Oh, yeah.
He ended up just passing right after. I'm totally getting chills after that, you know?
Yeah, so he was incredibly dramatic all the time. I mean, nothing he said was ever without drama. And so he had been on the inpatient unit when he was dying. And, you know, we talked about that because, you know, I asked him, what did he think was happening? And I ended up telling him that you're dying now, Frank. You know, this has been a long journey, but this is actually happening now. And so we had revisited tearfully that first day when he called me the scrappy little pup. And, you know, now we're approaching the last day and here I was because I still didn't go away. And so the night that he was passing, and again, here's one of those. So this for me would be a notebook moment, right? Because he was in and out of consciousness and he was able to wake up for a brief moment and somehow muster up the strength to put on the call light. And my coworker went in and he said, you know what I would like? Some vanilla ice cream. And so she somehow in the middle of the night found that vanilla ice cream. And when she brought it to him, he said, I want you to know I'm going to die when I finish this ice cream. And he ate the ice cream and then he did.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I chuckle at that because I can't imagine it being any other way because that's exactly who he was. You know, he would just, he had to have the last word and he had to go out on his terms. You know, and I remember getting told that he had passed and I got told the ice cream story and I just, you know, I laughed and I cried and I did all the things I think everybody does, you know, and I still have his photo, you know, it's hanging in my dining room. So quickly, just a tidbit on that story is that one day in the house, he said to me, go upstairs, you know, in the back bedroom, there's this brown paper bag, bring it down. And so I bring it down and he proceeds to take out all of these absolutely gorgeous, stunning headshots of him when he was in the ballet and when he was acting. And, you know, when he puts them across the table and we look at him and Frank was ridiculously hot. And I told him, I said, you know, you're going to have to allow me to be completely unprofessional, but like, what, you know? And I said, he goes, well, take what you want. You know, what am I going to do with them? And I said, well, I'm only going to take them on one condition. You have to autograph them for me. So I have this beautiful picture of Frank.
Oh, that's great.
Autographs. But yeah, that's, I mean.
Yeah, it's such a great story.
Yeah.
It's awesome. And it just highlights, you know, how did you know he was going to die? I'm just curious.
So he, you know, he had progressively lost weight. He had become bedridden. His disease process had affected his mentation. He was no longer eating. He wasn't really able to tolerate food or fluid. He was sleeping much more. He was having some changes in his symptoms, including pain and breathing. And, you know, he was not... forgive me, but as far as bodily functions go, you know, his kidneys were shutting down. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't peeing as much. I mean, these are all things that mm-hmm. happen, you know. You know, I just saw that coming for him. I could see that the wasting in his face. I could see the changes in his, you know, in just the figure of his body, his skin breaking down, all of those things that you had described essentially with mom. You know, for just a different disease process, but basically the same shutting down of the body in a different way.
And it's very, very interesting. You know, because I've heard before, like either in hospices or animals sometimes, or in convalescent hospitals or animals sometimes, like they'll keep a cat or they'll keep like a little dog, and those animals know, like they'll go to the room and they know who is going to pass. And that's how, you know, I've heard those stories before. Have you heard of anything like that?
So I, there's another, actual patient that was, you know, her daughter spoke about her in the film. And, it's not often that someone is lucid enough to be able to express to you when they are, I like to say when they have visions, because I think we use the term hallucination a little too loosely. And I say that regardless, you know, of what our, you know, your faith or beliefs are. I just think that, you know, we go somewhere that's other than here. And I think that when you get closer to wherever it is that we're going, there's sort of this space where you're able to kind of go check things out and kind of check back in here, you know, in our earthly being, if you will. And I don't consider them hallucinations because I think that they're closer to wherever they're going and it's just not for us to see. So it doesn't mean that it's not happening. And that particular patient, I came back in the next day for my shift and I was told that she had begun, you know, to have some visions overnight. So I went in and I said, good morning. You know, I heard you were seeing some things last night. And she said, Michelle, I swear to God, I'm not crazy. She said, last night, my brother walked in here and he pulled up a chair and he sat by my bed and we had a conversation for 45 minutes. And he's been dead for 15 years.
Wow.
And I said, well, I don't think you're crazy. You know, I said, I believe you. How was it? And she said, it was wonderful. And I don't feel afraid. Like, it was just wonderful. And, you know, and I said exactly that to her. I said, I think, you know, these are just things for you to see that are not for me to see because it's not my time. But that doesn't mean that's not happening. And I thanked her for sharing that with me because for myself, it sort of validated everything that I had been taught to believe in, you know?
I think that's a very interesting story. I mean, I want to share a quick story of my cousin's grandmother years ago. I think it was in about 2002. I had gone to Italy and I had reconnected with a lot of my family. And my cousin's grandmother, she just was doting on me. She loved me. She just wanted to talk to me all day. You know, she was washing my thong underwear. I mean, I was just like, you know, what is going on here? And my cousin's like, oh, just let her wash your underwear. She has nothing to do. Let her make the bed for you. She has nothing to do. And she was well into her late 80s, early 90s, you know, and she was pretty agile, but she was a very happy woman. And for some reason, and this happens a lot in the world, I get all these interesting people coming to me and they keep telling me things. And, you know, and I've been told by a shaman before, they're like, people come to you because they heal through you. And this is just what your purpose is. So, you know, she came to me and she starts talking to me and she goes, you know, when I die, I don't want people to be sad for me. She goes, I want there to be a party. I want there to be a party. I want people laughing, happy, singing, dancing. I want there to be a party when I go out. So years later, I think it may have been like 4 or 5 years or so, we get this phone call that she had passed. And I go, well, what happened? How did she pass? They're like, well, we were having her birthday party, like her 94th wow. birthday or something like that. And we were about to bring out the cake and she had a stroke and she was gone. And her daughter was like, well, she could have at least waited until we cut the cake for her to go. And she left. But I just thought it was so wild. And I just started laughing. As soon as I heard her pass and I asked how she passed, I was like, that's wild. And I told my mom, I was like, my God, she told me she was going to pass that way. Exactly the way. It was pretty wild.
Fascinating. I have a theory that, and I'm older than both of you gals, so I've had more decades to put it to the test, but I feel like as we age, we become exaggerated versions of who we've always been. So the three of us are very like-minded. We're upbeat, we're positive, we're gregarious, we're communicators. And that is not going to diminish, even though we might forget a word when we get older. We are not going to suddenly become angry, bitter.
I never know.
Later in life. But I watched the trajectory of my mother's life from childhood, like always with a cigarette, even while she was making dinner, eating dinner. I didn't see her. I'm 66 years old. I never saw my mother cry. She wasn't playful. She didn't laugh. So as she got older, she was vain. Her currency was her beauty. She was blonde, blue-eyed, a bombshell. Compliments were mother's milk to her. And she took that into her old age. And the fascinating thing was, this has nothing to do with religion. She did not have a spiritual core. She knew that I talked to my grandmother and communicate with a photo of my grandmother. We have a special bond. And she would tell people that, not so much in a judgy way, but the fact that she didn't have that special skill. And I saw her leave this world without a sense of, not that she embraced her religion, she didn't want to see a therapist. She had access. I found a therapist who would come to her house. She didn't want that. She didn't want a rabbi. She didn't want to talk to anyone. She didn't want to express her fears or her thoughts. And I just think that it's so important when you are young to develop the coterie of friends that you can count on, that we are social beings, that we have to communicate. And I said to a friend of mine, she just has no stories. And he said to me very wisely, he said, well, maybe that's why you have so many.
That's very interesting. It's a great point. You're just writing them for her, kind of, in a way.
Well, I'm just projectile vomiting stories. I'm telling oral history to my nephews and nieces and children of things my grandma told me, but I don't have mom stories. I think it's very sad I think it's great that the last people in her life, the coterie people that she could depend on, she didn't have friends. She had hospice nurses.
I think that that's a great point, and I'm just going to point out one thing, and I want to know if Michelle has heard anything of this before we start to wrap up here. There was this nurse in, I believe, Sacramento, and I had read this in the Sacramento Bee in June of 2017. And so the title of the article was, "What Will Your Last Words Be? Legacy Therapy Helps Dying Patients Tell Their Stories." And so there was a group of volunteers and a group of nurses, and I think they were trained by StoryCorps, which is a nonprofit organization, much like Nurses and Hypochondriacs, you know. And it is in kind of in alignment with what I'm doing with helping people tell their stories, where they would go and sit with people so that they could tell their stories of their life. And is there anything like that? And I think we talked about it before, Michelle, you and I, a little bit. Do you guys have any programs where you work that are like that?
Well, oh,
so ahead. Yeah. So I think the legacy piece is big, and I think that at a lot of hospices, that's a piece that volunteers can spend a lot of time with patients and work on legacy projects or legacy books. Previously, where I had worked, we developed a legacy video project where we were able to coordinate with someone who was willing to come in within a 24-hour time frame from time of call and record whatever it was that patient wanted and provide, you know, as many copies complimentary as they wanted to hand out. And there didn't have to be any set agenda, you know, if they wanted to share pieces of their life, they wanted to share a story, they just wanted to give a message, whatever it was. But I think that's hugely important because it asks the question of, you know, what do you want to leave behind? You know, what is the piece of you that we should all know indefinitely, you know? And I think that they're, another group of people doing work such as that, to some extent, are death doulas.
Right. I am so glad you brought that up. I want to hear more about the death doula and how that works.
And I don't have a lot of introduction with that, but I have a friend who practices as a death doula, and essentially they're non-medical personnel who are trained, you know, about end-of-life processes and on how to teach families and patients on what to expect, to be able to sit vigil at the bedside, to be able to honor the humanity in the dying process, and, you know, help organize things like legacy issues, help honor traditions, and sort of take away some of that companion burden time. I don't want to say burden, but they instill companionship so that there can be restful times for families, and help just provide calm.
Right. And that's a great subject matter you bring up, because I was reading a lot of articles, and in them they were saying that these family members, there was that time where either their family member needed pain medication or they were taking a turn and there was nobody there. They were calling the hospice doctors and nurses and nobody was answering, either a doctor wasn't there or anything like that. But I think in that instance, a death doula comes in very handy as another person kind of.
I agree 100%. I think, you know, the death doula can be comparable to a birth doula. You know, we put all of this preparation into preparing for a new life to come and having sort of a coach there to explain what's the next step and what can happen. And it's the exact same thing replicated at the end of life. So they're essentially end of life coaches that are there to tell you, this is normal. This is what happens next. You know, this is what we should do to prepare for this part. And just to provide a little calm to the storm. And I think they're wonderful.
It's interesting.
Fantastic idea. I think as a family member, I know, you know, being living 10 and a half blocks away from my mom, I had total easy access to her, unlike my siblings. And my children lived here, so they had access to their grandmother, and her other grandchildren did not benefit from that proximity. And I was able to intuit, as my mother got more taciturn, shut down, she would, my brother would come to town and he would say, "Mom's sleeping." And I would say, "No, she's not sleeping. She just doesn't want to talk to you. That's what she does. She closes her eyes when she doesn't want to talk." And I would say, "Mom, Josh is here. Open your eyes and just talk to him for 5 minutes. Just show him you're not dead. And just, you didn't have a stroke." And she would say, "What? What do you want me to say?" I said, "See, Josh, she's faking." So the point is that when I could intuit, knowing, being tuned into her and having this you know, constant, you know, vigil and being that person, I could see that she was slowly drifting to another planet. And I said to her a few months before she died, she stopped talking altogether. She sat, she just looked like waxworks and eyes closed. She stopped, the caregivers and nurses stopped using the Hoyer lift because she was just going to shatter like a porcelain teacup. And I said, Mom, let's start a new routine. When I say goodbye to you, I'm going to say, I love you. And then you say, I love you back to me. And the reason this sounds so bizarre is because she may have told me, I love you three times in my life. And so she turned to her caregiver and said, what the hell is she talking about? Get her out of here. And I said, okay, then just do one hand clapping. Mom, I love you. So the next time I came over, I said, Mom, remember our new routine we're doing? I love you. And she said, I love you too. And on some level, she found a peace in that. I mean, she said it through clenched gums, but she said it. And I got her to say, I think it's important for family members to realize that a lot of people do not leave here with a smile on their lips, feeling like they had a good long life. And to get them, you know, to kind of cajole them into being someone that they aren't comfortable being is very palliative for them.
I think that's an interesting point, and I'm just going to interject that kind of on a sidebar. I had an interview with the rabbi for one of the podcasts, and what he had said, now I'm not Jewish, but I think what he brought into mind was very interesting, and that all our listeners and us as well can take part, is to really be mindful of this life. And when we wake up in the morning, our breath, you know, and it is part of Jewish law to be thankful to God for what we have and getting out of bread, because you don't know what's going to happen. And we need to understand how we can make use of this world and what we can bring to it in a positive aspect, you know, with that. Before we wrap up, I just want to talk about just the business of hospice. I feel that every time, like, for example, when I looked on LinkedIn, it seems like someone is opening up a hospice business. And it seems like they're popping up on every corner, kind of like a McDonald's almost, because it is big business. I even met someone online on a dating site who had said he owned a hospice, and I connect with him because I was like, ooh, okay, I'm preparing this podcast. I want to know a little bit more. So he was an ex-paramedic working for an ambulance company, and he had retired from that. And someone was opening up a hospice, so he jumped in on that. So I was asking him about the dying process and about the business and everything that goes on. And he's like, oh, I don't know anything about that, which really scared me, you know. And he also did mention that there are some of these physicians who are kind of like ambulance chasers, but they're death chasers, you know. And there have been some underhanded people in the hospital facility, like telling certain physicians, oh, this patient's going to die or whatever, so that they'll go to that hospice. Can you talk a little bit about that, Michelle? Have you seen that in your industry? Or,
I mean, I think just as a general, I guess, a general opinion, you know, unfortunately, at the end of the day, medicine's a business, you know, right. And hospice, although it's underutilized and it's vastly needed, and I think that, you know, it has never not been there, but I feel like now it's sort of more up and coming as we start to change the culture moving forward. But hospice really isn't a money maker. It's not the part of medicine where the money is made. I mean, it's regulated by Medicare. There are certain, you know, stipends that you get depending upon the level of care someone is on hospice. But I also think that is some of the pushback in, you know, referring people to hospice sooner, is that where it helps hospitals is that if someone passes on it on a hospice admission in the hospital on an inpatient unit, it takes them off of the mortality statistics of the hospital because they technically died on the hospice service, not on the hospital service.
Interesting.
But when you are on the hospital service and you are providing comfort focused care, you know, you might still be maintaining that ICU bed, you know? Mm-hmm. So when, instead of doing the discharge and readmission, which is really more of a technical insurance paperwork process, you staying on different services and, you know, I don't know that I've seen negative undermining to have people come onto a hospice service with ill intent for the patient. But I think that, you know, the marketing piece of hospice is a challenge because it's misunderstood, because it's not, the culture needs to change from the time of medical school, from the time of nursing school, you know, and so there's this older generation of clinicians and physicians out there, you know, that we're not necessarily going to be able to change the way they're thinking or how they're referring. You know, we're certainly trying, but I think trying in a positive aspect, not necessarily the negative. But I think the one thing to everybody should stay focused on is that although medicine is a business, we're in the business of taking care of people, and we have to just be really careful that we don't completely remove the humanity in the medicine.
You know? And that's an excellent point. Excellent point. So any takeaways, Lisa, any advice that you would like to offer any family member or Michelle or Lisa? Go ahead, Michelle.
I wanted to quickly offer Lisa something to, when you were mentioning that in the advanced care planning for mom that you'd wished, you know, maybe you started cleaning a little bit. I actually started to read this book, and I will send you the author, forgive me, I don't know it, but it's she's a Swedish woman, and she wrote a book that is called The Art of Swedish Death Cleaning.
Interesting.
And it actually was a true testament to everything you had said in starting to declutter sort of at different checkpoints in your life, so that when you are getting older, it's not this whole house full of stuff that you are now in an empty nest trying to fish through and sort and decide what to keep and what not to keep. And so the practice of death cleaning should begin much sooner in just really a declutter with a purpose, if that makes sense.
I concur, and I told my kids that, number one, when I'm my mother's age of when she died, I will have been dead for 18 years. That's my gift to them. I also told them that I will start to declutter and donate and die with a bed, a spoon, a bowl, a fork, a cup, and a lamp. And that's how much I love my children. My mother was interviewing a caregiver once, and strangers seemed to bring out the best, most Sophie Tucker in her. And she was interviewing this woman, and this sums it up. And she said, and the woman said, "Oh, you have 5 children?" And she said, My children are garbage, but my grandchildren are perfect." So
she sounds like John Paul Getty.
That's what I was dealing with. But it is a testament of your love and parting gift to your partner, your family, your children, whomever is left when you're not here, when the animals have licked the dog food off your dead body and eaten your bones, but left the titanium rods and screws on the ground in the forest, to have everything as turnkey, as simple, so they can, your lasting memory of your deceased loved one is one of joy. The USPS has lost my mother's mail. My mother is still tormenting me from the afterlife because they lost her mail. It's literally in the dead letter office. I am still battling the post office for her mail. And so I just demystify the topic of death, because we are, as humans, we are born absurd. We are absurd. We are ridiculous. And as I teach in my classes, we are hardwired for beginning, middle, end, whether it's breakfast, lunch, dinner, morning, noon, and night, birth, life, death. So to not fear it, to live fully, to be grateful right. that out of all the eggs and sperms, you got to be made, you got to live, you got to inhabit this planet and watch everybody else trash it. It's just a respect for life and eventually a respect for death, whether it's somebody else's or yours.
Excellent point. Michelle?
I think that's beautiful. And I think that, you know, any life lived is a life worth celebrating, and that there are so many things that get in the way of allowing us to do that when we avoid these conversations. And I just think that as a society, as a medical community, we need to move, you know, more towards a more death positive outlook, you know, and increase death awareness and, you know, make room for these things so that we can, you know, get some of the things that tend to get in the way all at the wrong times from celebrating all of the best parts of each of us, you know, and just remember that at the very end, you know, people don't change who they are, you know, and they're not defined by their diseases. And so just because their bodies change and this process is happening, it doesn't mean that that person that you've known and loved or, you know, befriended has changed. And I'd hate for anybody to miss the opportunity to just have another, you know, one more second with each other, just being.
Yeah, that's a ticket. Anything you ladies would like to promote? Anything you're working on? We have your movie, Michelle. Where can people see your movie, The Nurse with the Purple Hair?
Yeah, so we have a website, and it's literally thenursewiththepurplehair.com. There is a preview to the movie on there. The movie in its entirety is 49 minutes. It can be purchased on the website. It can be purchased if you email me, because I have hard copies, and it's also available on Amazon.
Great. And people in your email?
Yes, so my email is purplehairnurse@yahoo.com.
Excellent. And Lisa, anything you're working on right now? Where are you performing?
Well, I'm doing story shows around town. I'm finishing up a class next week, so I'll have more time for storytelling. But I tend to publish my storytelling stories on my WordPress site. So if you just Google Lisa Medway WordPress, you can read some of my appropriate and less appropriate stories. Some are G-rated and some are not. But I am writing this book, The Designated Daughter. So I'm workshopping a lot.
I love that. I love that. I hope you really, I hope you finish it and get it published.
Yeah, it's pretty much.
I can see it being good. I have I'm getting goosebumps, Lisa.
Well, it's pretty much Ursula, because I kept it. This is something else, recommendation, because I'm a teacher. I kept a journal over the last many years of my mother's life and death. And I, as part therapy, part commerce, I would come home and write down everything that happened during that visit. So a lot of this collection of stories, it jumps between time from the end of her life to the beginning of my life, and then in between, and then it's summed up at the end. So it's written as a story collection, and because I am hopefully a comedy writer, there is a sarcasm, a lightness, and a very dark comedy lens focused on the relationship with my mother. And what I've discovered as I've been writing this and talking about it is it's not a love letter to my mother. It is a very objective and unfiltered, unsanitized account of my relationship with my mother, warts and all. So I found a lot of women, especially my age, had a similar mother, so it could be generational. So that, I'm working on that, and just doing my thing, being a spunky old lady.
Excellent. Well, thank you both ladies for being on. It was a great conversation, very informative. I think a lot of our listeners here on Nurses and Hypochondriacs can relate. There's valuable information. Both of you are such great consultants, advisors, you know, so knowledgeable on all of this process. Please listen, please download, go to our Facebook page, Nurses and Hypochondriacs. Please donate, go to our GoFundMe page. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, so just follow us around and keep listening. Thank you so much.